We love jewelry, but what we love even more is jewelry that is sustainable and good for our planet. Coco in Eden is committed to making beautiful pieces that are not only stunning for you, but are environmentally friendly. We love that Coco in Eden is 100% carbon neutral, meaning the company produces oxygen equivalent to the amount of CO2 it produces. Another thing we love about Coco in Eden is that their jewelry is built to last. Every piece is anti-tarnish, waterproof, hypoallergenic, and comes with a 2-year guarantee. Mel and I both have Coco in Eden jewelry, and we adore our pieces. Mel's necklace is stunning. I'm actually really jealous of it. And my bracelet and my ring, they're two of my favorite accessories. These pieces are beautifully made, fairly priced, and help our planet. What more could you want? Visit CocoandEden.com. That's CocoandEden.com and use the code TRUEGIRLS20 at checkout for 20% off your order today. Do you love podcasts? Do you have an idea for a podcast you think the world should hear? Then head to Buzzsprout. Buzzsprout is an easy way to produce, promote, and track the success of your podcast. We use Buzzsprout for True Girls and absolutely love it. Buzzsprout walked us step by step through the process of getting our podcast up and running and also helped us get listed on major directories like iTunes and Spotify. I'm honestly shocked at how smooth and user-friendly the process of getting this podcast up and running was. Follow the link in our show notes to let Buzzsprout know we sent you. You'll get a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan, and you help support our show. Check out Buzzsprout today to make your amazing podcast idea a reality. Welcome to True Girls, the podcast where two girlfriends tell you the true stories of fascinating women, both past and present. Stay true. Welcome, everyone, to True Girls.
Here we are.
We're back. And
what is it? What are you having?
I'm having a, drumroll please, a baby boy.
Yay!
I know. It's exactly what Melinda wanted.
It is.
We already have UCF onesies from Melinda.
Yes, yes.
She's already signed him up for T-ball.
Yep.
Five years from now, he's on the list. He's ready to go. So, yeah, we're really excited.
I'm so excited.
It was one of those things where, like, as soon as I got the call, I was like, I've only ever wanted a baby boy in my life. But I'm excited. So, Mel, I have some questions that I want to ask you before we jump into today's episode. And I didn't put them in the script because I wanted your genuine, like, off-the-cuff re-answers. Okay. Your answers. And some of them are, like, really weird. And some of them are just, like, bizarre questions. They're meant to mess with you.
Okay.
So, ready?
Uh-huh.
Here's number one.
Okay.
If you could completely get rid of 1 month out of the year, what month would it be and why?
Oof, August. Because it's hot as balls outside. I hate August in Florida. It's the worst time ever.
Yeah, and, I can see that.
And like school starts. No one wants to go back to school. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't like August. If I could skip from July to September.
I kind of feel partial to August because my birthday is in August.
Okay, well.
But it's August 31st, so it's basically
so
September.
It's basically September.
I'm basically a September baby.
Yeah, we could just go skip the 1st through the 30th.
Yeah, we'll have August 31st and that's it. I would say August because it's just so hot here.
It's
or
so hot.
March. I really don't like March because, my husband's a CPA. He's an accountant.
Uh-huh. Oh,
so
yeah, okay.
March, he's literally working 7 days a week, like really long hours every day. Uh-huh. So I don't see him at all during the month of March, which is really sad.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, it's Saturday and I don't have anything to do and I just want to, like, I don't know, go strawberry picking with my husband or, like...
But it's tax season.
Go to the zoo or something, but it's tax season, so I'm, like, by myself a lot. Mm-hmm. So I'd probably say March just to, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because I miss him during that time.
Yeah.
All right, ready?
Yes.
Number two. What's the funniest place you've ever fallen asleep?
Oh, no. I feel like you asked me this because you already know this story.
No.
I fell asleep in an orange grove in Vero Beach once.
Honestly, I did not have that in mind when I wrote down this question, but now that you say it, oh my gosh. Children, this is why we don't drink and go on walks by ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, just briefly to go over the story, I won't go into too much detail, but I was basically, like, it was like my first or second year in college away from home, and I was living in this, I was actually staying at my grandmother had like a guest house basically on her mm-hmm. property, and so she lived really close to where I was going to school, so I just stayed there. And it's literally like, it was made inside like my grandfather's old, like, garage where he built like and restored cars in. Mm-hmm. So like it's literally concrete and you can't hear anything inside or out of it. So like
sounds
it was
like a
party
murder
central.
House.
It was party central. Like everyone I knew in college, like everybody went to Mel's because that's just because you couldn't hear anything.
Like,
you couldn't
I felt hear like you were describing a true crime episode. No, like you couldn't hear anything.
You couldn't hear anything because it's like cinder block. It's like solid concrete yeah. brick. So but anyway, so that was just like we had all these parties, and basically I was at a party at my house and was drinking a lot of Arbor Mist for some reason. And I mean like those big bottles, and I think I had like two by myself.
Oh
that
my
night.
God.
Like literally from the bottle. And I remember getting into some fight. I got mad. I walked out of my house and basically said, fuck you all. Walked out of my house, was just walking down the street. Passed out in an orange grove and then woke up at like 7 a.m. the next day underneath an orange tree.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I had not fallen asleep anywhere weird, but one of my favorite stories is when I was younger, I went to Disney with my family and we were at Epcot mm-hmm. and it was Christmas time. And my grandfather had difficulty walking long distances. Mm-hmm. So he had one of the scooters and was riding his scooter around. So we get to Germany in the World Showcase. Mm-hmm. And we're all like, okay, we're going to go into the store. And he was like, all right, I'm going to stay outside. And so we go into the store and we come out. Literally, he is parked in the middle of the sidewalk, passed out with all these people, literally hundreds of people just kind of walking around him. And I'm like, why is nobody checking on him? There's like this old man just like leaning back, lying
he could be dead
in his scooter in the middle of Walt Disney World.
Wow,
That's just like classic.
That's funny.
Classic grandpa for me. Like that's what amazing. That's what my grandpa would do. So, yeah, that's one of my best sleep stories. Mm-hmm. All right, I have four questions for you.
Okay.
So two down, three. What is the worst hair or fashion choice you've ever made?
Oh God,
I'm excited for this one.
So in middle school, I was just super into wrestling and I was super into the Hardy Boys specifically, and the Hardy Boys, Matt and Jeff Hardy, had a very distinct look about them, mm-hmm. especially Jeff Hardy was very famous for wearing like neon colored like fishnet arm things or like, you know, like arm warmers, but they like mm-hmm. with cuts and stuff in mm-hmm. them. So I was going through this phase in middle school and I was just like this weird goth kid and I wore big black JNCO jeans. Do you remember JNCO jeans? They're literally like,
yes,
they're like the size of one leg and could fit yeah. over your entire body. So I had those. I would wear like all black, but I had my neon green fishnet underneath my clothes. And I was like, Melinda.
First of all, you're so tiny. I can't even imagine like 5 foot nothing Mel in these wide ass pants. Oh my God.
Yeah. That was probably the worst decision I ever made. And I definitely stole them from like my cousin or something. Like he was like, they were not mine. Yeah. Like I yeah. definitely took them from someone.
You had to steal them from someone.
But like that was like my look back then.
That's
I was
amazing.
Just, like I wanted to be Jeff Hardy so bad.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
It was bad.
It was the summer before I was going to college. Mm-hmm. And I watched The Bachelorette for the first time. And okay. She had bangs.
Oh, no.
And I thought they were really cute. And I was like, how hard can it be to cut bangs?
Oh, no.
So I'm in the bathroom and I'm like holding my hair. And my little brother comes in and he still tells this story and he will not let me live it down. He goes, Kayla, that's not a good idea. And I was like, shut up, Zach. You don't know what you're talking about. And so I just take it.
Oh, no.
And instead of cutting below my fingers, I cut above my fingers. No. My hair was so, like, stupid short to the point where I had to wear, like, headbands to push the bangs back, or I had to constantly bobby pin them back because they were so bad. I mean, most people cut their own hair, but they're, like, 5 or 6 when they do it.
Right.
I was 17.
Did you, like, go to a salon and was like, is there anything you can do to fix this?
So no, I didn't. I let it grow out. And then mm-hmm. When I was in college, my freshman year, so I went to the University of South Carolina, which is in Columbia, South Carolina. So it's mm-hmm. in a city. And there was a Paul Mitchell school near our campus within mm-hmm. walking distance from my dorm. And this girl I was friends with went and got her hair done there. And it mm-hmm. looked really good. And her highlights looked good. And I was like, okay, well, all I want is, like, a cut.
Right.
And my hair was relatively long at the mm-hmm. time. And I go in and I get assigned this woman. I won't go into too much detail about her. but before I know what she's done, she's literally cut my hair off and she's like, locks of love. And I was like, oh no, that was not the point. So my hair was super short. And then instead of cutting like multiple layers, she literally cut two, like a longer layer and then a shorter layer. It was kind of like a bowl cut on top of a bowl cut.
Oh no. Why would they do that to you?
It was so awful. And I was like,
I need photos.
Well, luckily, if I were to wear my hair straight, it was really bad. But yeah. if I curled it, uh-huh. I could curl it in a way to hide it.
Right.
But then a couple of months later, I go back home to Wake Forest, North Carolina, and I mm-hmm. go to my hairdresser. And she was just like, dear God, what happened to your hair? She was like, who did you let touch your hair? This is horrible. And I was like, I know.
I know.
I've been living with it for months. I mean, my hair was short. It was like above my shoulders.
Yeah.
Short, which is really
weird for you.
Really weird for me. Yeah. Okay. My last question.
Okay.
What Disney character or cartoon character? Mm-hmm. So think animated world. Okay. Were you inexplicably A, afraid of?
Okay.
Or B, attracted to as a child.
Okay. So I don't know. I mean, I'm just going to give you answers to both.
Okay.
But I wasn't really afraid of any of them. I think actually Trenobog or whatever.
Oh,
from
yeah.
Freaked me the fuck out.
The big guy that lives in like the volcano.
The one
thing,
that does the one from Fantasia 2000 or whatever.
Yes.
The front, you know, that music is like super popular.
Terrifying.
Yeah, he freaked me out. Like, I was not into that. And I was like, giant devil thing? Didn't like it.
Not my vibe. Not my vibe.
I am inexplicably attracted.
Oh, still are.
Yes. Oh, yeah, still are. This is still a thing. Kovu from Lion King 2, which is like...
This is a whole nother layer, because this is an animal we're talking about. This is an animated animal.
Yes.
Oh.
He's a really sexy lion. I don't know. And there is an entire people, listeners, help me out and comment on the whatever on our Facebook link when we post this episode. Comment, subscribe, click whatever you need to do.
Mel needs your support.
I do. I really need your support because there is an entire online community about this fact. And there's even like a Cards Against Humanity card that like even says about like how attractive Kovu is, like,
have gone as with this.
As the character.
Wow. Not only do you think he's sexy, you felt the need to go and Google.
He's like a, it is a thing. It's a thing that exists.
So we're just clarifying, you're not the only person
in the
world.
Yes, I am
feels
not
this
the
way.
Only person who feels this way. It's not just like his looks, okay? It's his attitude, right? Uh-huh. Kovu's like the bad boy, right?
You put so personality
like,
above
like
species.
You could put him, you could put him in like a leather jacket. Well, and here's the thing. I'm not surprised because I'm like super into like werewolves, right? Like in werewolf books and like... I don't hate, if they were real and someone was like, yo, Ben was like, yo, I'm a werewolf, I'd be like, okay.
You'd be cool. Like, wow, why am I more attracted to you?
Yeah, exactly.
In this moment.
So, okay. I don't know. It's weird. But, okay. Yes, so that, it is very unexplainable. I don't know. I guess it's his vibe. I don't know. And he is weirdly attractive. And I don't know if guys listen to this podcast, but if you do, well,
did you have a crush on Nala?
Straight men. Because there's like a whole other online community that is like, kind of talks about how they're attracted to, what's her name? Max, no, not Max, Roxanne from the Goofy movie.
To be your Google browser. To just know the things that you Google.
I don't know how I find these things. I guess it's like targeted advertising, right? Like targeted.
Melinda goes to the other side of the internet.
I don't know, but like, it is a thing. These are Reddit threads. Like, you can find these.
So, anyway. Mine are not as obscure as that. When I was little, I always had a reoccurring nightmare about Maleficent from Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, I love her.
My dream was that, like, my family was driving through a corn maze and she would try and shoot us with her staff thing.
Okay.
I had that dream, like...
I get that.
Regularly.
She turned into a dragon.
Yeah, so that was, like, a regular
dream
that I had. And then my crush, my animated crush, was definitely, without a doubt, Shang.
Oh.
From Mulan.
I feel that.
He's just like muscly,
and
chiseled AF.
And was like, I don't fuck around.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Shang was definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. He cute.
He was a cutie poo. Mm-hmm. He was a cutie poo. So.
All right. Now that we got all that.
Now that we learned a lot about Mel.
Her bestiality tendencies.
Sleeping in orange groves, having a crush on
I wasn't meant to be a human. Maybe. Actually, that makes a lot of sense because I kind of hate people and kind of love animals. So
yeah, that would all track. So today we are going to be exploring a truly, truly amazing story. Now, this is a woman who was super influential during the Harlem Renaissance, and her impact is still felt today. As a reminder, the Harlem Renaissance was this amazing explosion of African-American literature, music, art, and culture from 1910 through the 1930s that took place really all over the country, but it was truly centered in Harlem, New York. And the Harlem Renaissance occurred due in part to the Great Migration, which was a movement of African-Americans moving out of the South and into northern, more urban cities. And they created these new environments that were really open and accepting of different kinds of people and identities. And it was a place where the arts could truly flourish. Mm-hmm. It was one of my favorite things to discuss when I was a high school English teacher because it has some of the most amazing creators, such as Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, Louis Armstrong, and so many more. But today, I really want to look at a woman who we don't necessarily learn about when we look at the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. Today we are looking at the life of Gladys Bentley. Now, if you have a little one listening, just be aware that this episode may be rated R at some points in time, so listen with caution. Also, for our LGBTQ+ community, there may be some triggering topics because our woman was gay in the 1920s and 1930s, so her treatment was less than stellar at times. This episode is all about Gladys Bentley, one of our true girls, and I have a feeling that most people haven't heard of her, but trust me, you are going to be so glad that you did. Mel, can you give us our three basic facts about Gladys?
With pleasure. Okay, so number one, Gladys was one of the most financially successful Black women in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. She ran away from home at age 16. And then number three, Gladys was openly gay for most of her life, which is incredibly impressive and brave during that time period. I would imagine that definitely was not something that anybody was relatively out about often.
Yeah, it'll be interesting once we get into it to kind of talk about that.
Yeah.
The amount of information about Gladys's life that is out there is actually pretty slim. I couldn't find any books on her or any articles that really detail her early life. Mm-hmm. I have a theory for why this is, but we'll get to that at the end of the episode. Gladys was born on August 12, 1907 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania to George L. Bentley and Mary Bentley. Her father was from the United States and her mother was from Trinidad. According to Gladys, she was neither wanted nor loved because her mother had wanted a son and instead got a daughter. Now, Gladys had three younger brothers, so her mother would eventually get her wish with the son thing, But this all kind of bothers me that her mother was resentful, because being pregnant now, it's like, I just want my baby.
Yeah.
Before, I mean, if I'm being honest, before I knew what we were having, I was kind of hoping for a girl. But mm-hmm. as soon as I found out it was a little boy, it was like, all I've ever wanted was to be a boy mom. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to explain, but I just feel like you love your kids so much, you'll love them no matter what. So the fact she experienced this as a child is just really sad.
Yeah, that is really sad. And like, who, yeah, I can't imagine, because like everything I always hear, I mean, I'm not a mom. I will probably never be a mom, which is totally fine. But like, I find it weird because from every person that I've ever met in my life has always been like, I don't really care what they are as long as they're healthy and that I actually like carry them to full term and give birth to them. Like they never cared what gender they were or
yeah, whatever. Exactly. And so, like, you know, I've already been to the hospital twice during this pregnancy, yeah. to the ER twice. So all I want is my baby. Like that's right. all I want. I'm just ready for September to be here. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want my baby here. Yeah. And I can't imagine anybody not
being like
feeling that way.
But
like
you're a girl.
Like I know parenthood is different for everybody, and I know motherhood is different for everybody. But there's just something about like your baby that's like growing inside of you. You know. So
interesting.
I know. Gladys didn't have a lot of money growing up, and her family definitely struggled financially. From a young age, Gladys was openly defying traditional female behavior. She was made fun of at school for being overweight, and at one point she had feelings for a female school teacher. She would regularly get sent home from school for wearing boys' clothes. Most of the time it was her little brother's suits. Her parents were not fans of this, and so they began taking Gladys to doctors to try and, quote-unquote, cure her.
I find that super interesting, considering that her mom wanted a boy in the first place. So then it's like, I feel like there's a lot of psychology that I am not equipped and
there's a lot
educated
unpack.
About to mm-hmm. make that kind of diagnosis or whatever yeah. on this situation. Yeah. But I find that super interesting.
I think basically they were looking for conversion therapy.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't displaying traditional female traits, which yeah. is so wrong. Again, like with this baby that I'm having, I don't care who he loves. I don't care who he decides to right. be. Like, just I'm going to love him no matter what.
Right.
With every fiber of my being. Like,
I just want him to play sports. That's his only not option.
Well, the thing is, like, I'm his mom, right?
yeah.
And if I'm not there cheering him on and supporting him, mm-hmm. you know, who is going to be? I'm his right. first cheerleader. I'm going to be his right. biggest supporter. And he's not even going to be born until September, and I already love him more than anything
yeah.
in this world. So it just makes me sad when parents don't accept their kids the way that they are.
Yeah.
And it's honestly a little mind-blowing to me
yeah.
when they don't, especially now kind of getting an idea of what it feels like
yeah.
to be a parent.
Hmm.
There's really no more information other than that on Gladys's early life. But I think it's pretty clear this was not a happy, supportive home for her to grow up in, allowed her to be her truest self. And, you know, things at school weren't much better. So at age 16 in 1923, Gladys ran away to Harlem, New York. She said of this, "Some decide to take the reins of their destiny in their own hands. That is the way I reacted to being an unwanted child." Mm. And this is where her story really takes off. Gladys was a very talented singer and pianist, and soon after moving to the city, she was offered $400 by a Broadway agent to record 8 tracks, which in that time is a lot of money.
Yeah.
While this was an amazing deal, Gladys wasn't satisfied with recording. She liked having a live audience, so she would perform at rent parties and buffet flats. These were really popular during the Harlem Renaissance. The rent parties were where tenants would hire a musician or a band to play in their apartment, mm-hmm. and then they would pass around a collection to pay their rent. Along with these rent parties, Gladys also started filling in at local bars when their entertainers were unavailable. This eventually led to her becoming the pianist at the Madhouse in Harlem. The boss at the Madhouse originally wanted a male pianist, but Gladys convinced him to let her play one time. Like, just give me one night.
Mm-hmm.
And she was such a hit with the audience that she got offered a regular contract on the spot.
That's awesome. I don't know if these rent parties still happen, but I want to think that they do.
Wouldn't that be so nice?
Because that sounds like my kind of vibe. Like, mm-hmm. that sounds like something that I would, like, be super into.
Yeah.
Both attending, throwing them, playing at them, like, whatever.
Right?
I just really like the idea of a rent party. That's super interesting.
So after she gets hired at the Madhouse, Gladys's career really started to take off. Before I dive into that, though, I want to give everyone an overview mm-hmm. on Gladys as a performer. So Gladys was known as having a bulldagger or a butch identity. She was 250 pounds, so she was tall. She was a bigger woman.
Yeah.
And she always wore a white suit and a top hat. Love Her it. Stage name was Bobby Minton. She had this deep, sexy alto voice, and she would straight up flirt with women in the audience.
Love this.
She sang about women's rights, sexual freedom, equality, and all of these really important and progressive topics. She would also take popular songs and make them super raunchy. And when I say super raunchy, she took a popular song and literally made it all about anal sex.
Mm-hmm. I love that. It's like Bo Burnham.
Yep. She would encourage the audience to sing along with her naughty lyrics, which of course they would get a kick out of. Mm-hmm. And her act was a smash hit. And people loved it.
It's like a drag show.
Well, so from what I've seen, this really was a drag king performance. It's not believed that Gladys herself was transgender because she always used female pronouns when referring to mm-hmm. herself. I love her voice, so I'm going to play a quick clip of Gladys okay. singing and playing the piano. Okay. So this is a song called Worried Blues. Okay. So it's her playing mm-hmm. and it's her singing.
Okay.
Treat us women like you do. I'll make you mean, folks. Treat us women like you do. I don't want no man that I got to give my money to.
Yes. Isn't she great?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh.
I know.
I love her.
I could listen to her sing just all day long. Like her little like trumpet riff that she does.
Yeah.
Oh, all of it. So, so good. So her onstage identity was really this kind of drag, quote, bull dagger was the expression used.
Right.
Personality.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So was Gladys's identity accepted when she was performing?
She really embraced her lesbian butch identity when she was performing, and she was really popular for it. That's not to say there wasn't outrage at the time over what she was doing.
There'd be that now.
Right. She was called perverted, deviant, all these things. And her personal life was not accepted. But gay expression regarding performing was actually being explored at this time, and it's due in large part to the Prohibition era, where it was illegal to purchase alcohol. This led to bootlegging and speakeasies, as we all know. Mm-hmm. But what it also did was it provided these different and unique performers venues and spaces to really explore and hone their craft, including the embracing of gay identity in these club and speakeasy settings. So in the setting of the nightclub and of the speakeasy.
That was what people wanted.
It's what people wanted, right? Mm-hmm. It was... I mean, they were drinking. They, were, already doing something illegal. Things, and it was just this exploration of identity that people really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. So, yes, on stage, it was 100% accepted.
Interesting.
Gladys began performing regularly at clubs like Harry Hansberry's Clam House, which was a gay nightclub, the Ubangi Club, which was another gay nightclub, and then the Cotton Club. So she performed at some more, like, mainstream sort of places as well. But one of my favorite stories about her performing is when she did a show at the Ubangi Club that had her as a drag king and then had a chorus of, it was said, 30 drag queens behind her.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I would love that
I would
show.
Love to go back in time and see
Me
that.
Me too.
That
would
be so
All right,
fun.
Someone invent a time machine.
We need to go see Gladys and her queens perform.
Please. So that's her as a performer. But did Gladys embrace her sexual identity in her personal life as well?
During this time, she definitely did. Gladys didn't try to hide the fact that she was lesbian. In fact, it was quite the opposite. She was known to be seen out with different women on her arm. And at one point, she claimed to have gotten married to her white female lover in a civil ceremony in Atlantic City. Now, I couldn't really find any specifics about who this lover was. Mm-hmm. But the point is, Gladys was not hiding the fact that she was lesbian. And she faced backlash for it.
Of course she did.
Yep. To be expected. But jumping back to her as a performer, because that's literally all I could find about her personal life during this time. There's just so little information about it. In 1928, Gladys started her recording career that lasted 20 years. And I'm so bummed because none of her recordings are the super raunchy songs that she would sing.
Yeah.
And I just really, really wanted to find one to play for everybody, but there was nothing out there. So Gladys's fame skyrockets. At one point, she does a national tour. She has a radio show. She gets a luxury car. She becomes wealthy enough to move into an expensive apartment on Park Avenue. And so, like, Gladys gets a little bougie.
As would we all.
As would we all. She said of her success later in her life, "The world has tramped the doors of the places where I have performed to applaud my piano playing and song styling. Even though they knew me as a male impersonator, they could still appreciate my artistry as a performer."
Yeah, I find that super interesting because it almost kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the Wilma Rudolph episode about, like, you know, you can represent our country and win all these competitions for us, but we can't accept you.
Right.
Right. So it's like almost it's the same kind of thing where it's like, well, you give us entertainment. And so we can accept your entertaining like this. It's almost like they're first of all, most people are probably in denial that her actual personal life is that. And they can just separate the person from the character that they like to see. But it's like, if you can accept the character that she is, why can't you accept that in, in real world? And so I find that super interesting that when it's advantageous to them, it's fine.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, what the fuck?
100%. So in 1929, we have the Wall Street crash, and this marks the beginning of the Great Depression. For the first part of the 1930s, Gladys is still successful. She's performing, she's making money, she's doing well for the most part. When Prohibition is repealed, what also happens is there begins to be a decrease in tolerance, and soon her act isn't as appreciated as it once was. Clubs and their content are starting to be regulated again and censored because they're now legal, and there's now oversight
now they what's have happening. To have, they actually have to have people actively, what's the word I want to use? Because it's like the FCC with the regulated, being regulated.
They're being
like,
regulated. So there was this push to shut down, quote, disorderly, unquote, establishments. And disorderly was basically code for gay.
Okay.
In 1934, Gladys was doing a run at King's Terrace on 52nd Street, but it was cut short because of police pressure due to the nature of her performance. Gladys's popularity, it began to wane at this time, so she moved to Los Angeles in 1937 and moved in with her mom. She became a popular entertainer in LA and the Bay Area, but at this point in her career, she has to start wearing skirts on stage to make the club owners happy. California actually had anti-cross-dressing laws from the 19th century to keep entertainment clean.
So you can't wear pants? I'm confused.
For a while, her home base, so to speak, is Mona's 440 Club, which was the first lesbian bar in San Francisco. So that's where she hung out for a while. So I'm glad she found like a nice little lesbian niche for herself where she could be herself, you know?
But she shouldn't have had to. That's neither here nor there. And the women couldn't wrestle either, so.
Yep. And Gladys, so she finds success on the West Coast, and there's actually a small resurgence of that same exploration of gay expression in clubs that was present during the Prohibition during World War II. But then after the war ends, the McCarthy era begins, which really cracked down on artistic expression, and especially that of gay performers. This was actually a time known as the Lavender Scare, which occurred almost simultaneously with the Red Scare, which most of us know. Which was this fear of communism, but the Lavender Scare was this fear of homosexuality. At one point, hundreds of government employees and officials were fired because they were accused of being gay. A headline that was published in a paper during this time said, "Purge of sex perverts in U.S. jobs is pushed."
That's ridiculous. Also, like, just for accused of being gay? Like, what, if they weren't actually gay? Yeah. Like, I just feel like there was people that were, I mean, not that you should have anyway, but it's like, first of all, how is it any of your business in the first place? It should have anything to do with where you work. If you come in, you do your job, that should be it, all that matters at the end of the day.
Like, who you love does not affect how you do your job.
Yeah, it doesn't equate to your competency in the workplace.
Exactly. And to me, this just speaks to how we should all really study and know our LGBTQ plus history, because I feel like people don't realize how bad things actually have been throughout history for the LGBTQ plus community, you know, and this is just an example. Like, we all know about the Red Scare, but how many of us have heard of the Lavender Scare?
Yeah.
You know?
And like, this is something that like we should just be learning about anyway, just as not like, because you can learn from that. Like, you don't need, like, and it doesn't have to be anything about gay people. It can be about people with blonde hair, people with, that are brunette, people
it's about
with red hair.
Identity acceptance.
It's literally like, does what you look like really, really matter?
Does what you look like,
at all?
Does who you love, does, you know, the choices you make about your personal yeah. life and who you choose to be.
Yeah.
Like, no.
Because I worked at a Hooters once, right? And so, like, but there was not a whole lot of body positivity there. Like, the women that were hired, none of them were bigger girls, like, ever.
Yeah.
I think more recently the company has, because of the progression of the way things are, the company has kind of maybe expanded on that, because I've seen, like, thicker girls.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's like, and I get it that, like, in that kind of environment you want, you know, a certain look, but, like, everybody also has different tastes. So even though they might be the quintessential beauty that you're looking for, maybe some of the guys that are in there don't care about that.
In order to truly understand a community, you need to understand what that community has been through. And mm-hmm. If you don't understand the history of Black people in this country, if you don't mm-hmm. understand the history of LGBTQ people in this country, like, you're not going to understand what they've been through, where they're coming from, and what mm-hmm. their culture and their identity is based around.
Right.
You know, like, that's just so important. All right.
All right.
So we need to all ready ourselves for an immediate right turn with Gladys. And I believe this is her reaction to all of this, like the lavender scare, mm-hmm. this push away from embracing your identity mm-hmm. as a performer, all of this. In 1952, Gladys published an essay in Ebony titled, "I Am a Woman Again." In this essay, Gladys claimed she had undergone hormone treatments that helped her identify as heterosexual and that she had met a man who she loved and she married him. And I don't know how genuine this is, if at all. I think there was a lot of public pressure on her to be the traditional woman that was accepted. Mm-hmm. And I think she felt that in order to survive and to keep performing, she had to basically change her identity because the identity she had for so long was no longer accepted.
Right.
In 1958, Gladys wrote an autobiography titled If This Be Sin, but it never got published.
Hmm.
And I couldn't find any information as to why this is. But Gladys died in 1960 at age 52 from complications of the flu. At this point in her life, she was actually studying to become a Christian minister.
Hmm.
So you remember at the beginning when I said there wasn't a whole lot of information on Gladys's early life mm-hmm. or really her life in general other than her career?
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's because of the fact, especially when she died, how taboo homosexuality had become.
Mm-hmm.
I think no one was willing to document it or explore it or fully mm-hmm. acknowledge that part of her life. And it's just devastating to think that so much of her story has been lost because of this.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is probably not that they were trying to brush it under the rug, but kind of,
mm-hmm.
you know, and at the time too. How many people were actively trying to go and seek her out?
Yeah. I mean, you know, within the last... She had obituaries you know. Published. Like right. people acknowledged her death.
Right.
She was still performing. She was right. still popular.
Right.
But
it wasn't something that people were actively going out and researching her life. And part of it is probably because they didn't... want to. They wanted to ignore that.
They were
part
more
of
comfortable
it.
With this new identity right. she had assumed. So they
right.
just kind of
they're just gonna leave it at that.
Left the old one behind.
Yeah.
People
just weren't gonna try and go find mm-hmm. out information about mm-hmm. her.
But her legacy from that early part of her career, right? That
mm-hmm.
that really gay expression part of her career, it lives on. Shirlette Amons is a modern day musician and recording artist who is working on an album inspired by Gladys.
Cool.
The album uses modern day musical styles to address issues facing certain communities, just like Gladys's music did during her time. Shirlette is Black and identifies as queer, and she feels that Gladys truly opened the door that she has walked through today. It's really beautiful, and Shirlette said of Gladys, quote, "She went back into the closet so that one day I would never have to do that," end quote.
Wow. That's a really good, it's a good quote, actually.
I know.
That's really important, I think.
I think it could be easy to get upset with Gladys and be like, I can't believe she turned her back on her
right.
identity, but...
Yeah, that's really easy.
But
to do.
The fact she even lived... her life the way she did in the first
mm-hmm.
place is beautiful
right.
and amazing and needs to be celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's important to understand what was going on culturally and historically mm-hmm. that forced her back
at that
into
time.
The closet.
Right.
You know?
And I mean, sometimes, and this is, I mean, it's kind of awful, but sometimes I guess you just have to realize that times were different and that at, you know, sometimes you can't blame people for those choices that might not be the choices you make.
Yeah.
Just because of, at the time, like, how much more dangerous was it for her at that time to and sometimes you have to pick survival over
self-preservation.
You know what
survival.
I mean, and it's like, you can't blame somebody for that. Even though there are those people who pushed that boundary and didn't necessarily maybe care about that and thought their self-sacrifice would do better. But you, I don't really feel like you can fault people for
And I think the fact that, you know, today we have people like Sherlette Amos who are able to, you know, she describes herself as being able to be unladylike on stage because Gladys set that precedent.
Right.
You know, 100 years ago.
Right.
And that's just so important.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she was kind of forced to turn her back on her identity does not negate any of the amazing work that she did
in her
life, you know? So that, my friends, is the wonderful, amazing, wildly talented Gladys Bentley, a.k.a. Bobby Milton.
Thanks for listening, y'all, and stay true.
Our sources for today are Gladys Bentley from blackpast.org, Gladys Bentley from The Heroine Collective, Gladys Bentley from The Legacy Project, Overlooked from The New York Times, and a little documentary on YouTube I recommend everybody watch called Unladylike 2020 from PBS. Oh.